This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 13, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Activists call on Brazil to keep its promise to make generic AIDS drugs more available. The Pentagon recommends closing 33 major military bases and hundreds of smaller outposts. And a look at race in the upcoming mayoral election in Los Angeles. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards Tigert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Uzbekistan, a clash between dissidents and government forces is simmering on the brink of open rebellion. Last night, protesters stormed a jail in the eastern city of Andijan to release 23 businessmen the government accuses of being involved with a banned Islamic group. They also freed all the prisoners there, nearly 2,000 in total, took hostages, and occupied an administrative building in the city. Today, soldiers opened fire on a crowd of 4,000 protesters, with estimates of the death toll running as high as 50. The Associated Press reports that protesters controlled a large swath of the city today, but that columns of troops and armored vehicles were moving toward it. The European Union blamed the unrest on the Uzbekistan government's failure to address widespread poverty and human rights violations. The Bush regime, which backs Uzbekistan's authoritarian regime as a key ally in the war on terror, called for both demonstrators and the government to show restraint. In neighboring Afghanistan, widespread protests escalated today as clashes with police left at least 8 people dead. Demonstrators first took to the streets on Tuesday after Newsweek magazine reported that interrogators at Guantanamo Bay put copies of the Holy Quran in toilets to unsettle prisoners. The protests are by far the largest under U.S. occupation. Nazif Shahrani is a professor of anthropology at Indiana University. He says the U.S.-backed government's violent response could further destabilize the country.
They have confronted the demonstrators with use of force, of violence, and that obviously is not good because it's going to produce martyrs. And once you have martyrs, it starts a vicious circle.
Shahrani says the protests show the Bush administration has squandered the goodwill it had following the invasion of Afghanistan. He attributes that to the failure to establish a democratic political system and to the abuses of Afghanistani prisoners. New allegations are surfacing that connect the abuses at Guantanamo Bay to those in Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Former Brigadier General Janis Karpinski has accused a high-ranking general who oversaw Guantanamo of introducing the most controversial torture techniques used at Abu Ghraib. Brian Zinn has more from Washington.
In an interview on Nightline, General Janis Karpinski said she feels that she and the other reserve officers were used as scapegoats for the scandal because the Pentagon considers them disposable. Karpinski said that General Jeffrey Miller, who oversaw the Guantanamo Bay prison and consulted in Iraq, had likely introduced some of the most controversial forms of abuse there. Karpinski said she does not believe that the military police at Abu Ghraib independently came up with the idea of putting dog leashes on prisoners or stacking them up naked in pyramids. She also said that prisoner abuse may still be occurring, saying, "Maybe people who are orchestrating have gotten smarter and have gotten better." The 6 soldiers charged for crimes committed in Abu Ghraib have all pleaded guilty or been convicted. Karpinski was reprimanded and relieved of her duties, but no criminal charges were brought against her. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Brian Zinn.
In Britain, the newly elected government headed by Tony Blair has just announced its first major policy initiative, increased privatization of health services. Britain's universal health care system has been the envy of many countries since it was established during the reform movements of the 1950s, but many fear today's announcement is the beginning of a plan to dismantle it. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
After a massive lobbying effort by the healthcare industry, Britain's health minister has announced today new contracts for private corporations worth more than £3 billion over the next 5 years. The idea is the private sector will help cut waiting times within Britain's National Health Service by enabling 2 million extra operations a year. But public sector unions are warning that this is just backdoor privatisation of a system that provides universal cradle-to-grave healthcare. Although treatment will still be free for patients, unions believe the private companies will cherry-pick the easiest operations in order to maximise their profit. And that, they say, will place a greater burden on the National Health Service, setting the stage for future cuts. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In Connecticut, a flurry of last-minute legal appeals failed to stop New England's first execution in 45 years. Michael Ross was executed early this morning while some 300 opponents of the death penalty held vigil outside. Melinda Tuhus reports from the Osborne Correctional Facility in Somers, Connecticut.
Ross had strangled eight young women in the early 1980s after raping most of them. He dropped his remaining appeals last fall and has been fighting to die ever since. In a second competency hearing in April, a judge ruled that even though he was mentally ill, his diagnoses did not impede his ability to choose to be executed after almost 20 years on death row. The prison warden made the death announcement at 2:30 a.m.
In accordance with the sentence of capital punishment imposed by the Superior Court, the execution of Michael Bruce Ross has been carried out in the manner prescribed by the laws of the state of Connecticut.
Just before the execution, Roger Vann, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut.
No matter how hard we try, the reality is that the state is killing in our name this evening. And it's very difficult for activists who've worked for abolition for many, many years to realize that on our watch, the execution of a human being is taking place after 45 years. But the presence of so many people this evening really shows that we're strong in number and that we're going to fight until we achieve abolition in the state.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus at the Death House in Somers, Connecticut.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Pentagon released its recommendations to close 33 major military bases and 775 smaller military outposts throughout the United States. President Bush has until September to consider the recommendations, which would result in the loss of tens of thousands of military positions and civilian jobs. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington.
The Base Realignment and Closure Commission, also known as BRAC, is recommending to shut down dozens of military bases and hundreds of smaller outposts nationwide that would result in the loss of over 10,000 military positions and over 18,000 civilian jobs. Undersecretary of Defense Mike Wynn says there will be assistance for the communities that would be struck the hardest.
We are going to put some grants for studies. We have a new a presidential executive order that's an outreach, and we are assigning a program manager to each major affected community so that they will have somebody to turn to and call to and somebody to perhaps take them through what we think is a very difficult a period of time here.
But when pressed by reporters, it didn't appear that that much help would be on its way.
I'm trying to provide them with some assistance via grants so that they can conduct some studies. But this is something I think the community is going to have to individually assess.
Some of the largest bases that are recommended to be closed include a submarine base in New London, Connecticut, Fort McPherson in Georgia, Pascagoula Naval Station in Mississippi, and Fort Monmouth in New Jersey. It is estimated that more than 8,000 jobs would be lost in Connecticut alone. Lawrence Korb with the progressive think tank the Center for American Progress is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under the Reagan administration.
If the communities work together, the business and government people in the community take advantage of whatever federal programs you have, within 5 or 6 years you can be at least as good and maybe even better than you were before. The bases that were closed in 88, 91, 93, and 95, actually those communities on average have done better than the American economy as a whole, and they got about 85% of the jobs that they lost. They've gotten back already.
But for the first few years, these areas are going to take a major hit, are they not?
There's no doubt about the fact that there is a down period, and I think that's where you need to take advantage, not just of the money that the Department of Defense offers through their Office of Economic Adjustment, but things like the Small Business Administration, things like government training programs for laid-off government workers.
The Pentagon claims that the base closures will save $50 billion over the next 20 years.
When you look at the numbers, it's about $2 billion a year for the next 20 years. That's a drop in the bucket in terms of the Defense Department's budget.
Charles Pena is a military specialist with the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. Though he doesn't think $50 billion over 20 years is all that much, he does support the closures of the bases, saying it's not the military's role to maintain local economies. Pena says the BRAC recommendations begin to address Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's vision of creating a smaller and faster military.
We are, on the whole, trying to make the military smaller, lighter, more agile, more easily deployed. And this BRAC recommendation certainly reflects that thinking.
The president will have until September 23rd to act on the BRAC recommendations. Until then, lawmakers will be lobbying hard to save the bases within their own districts and states. Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton says she'll be working to save the Niagara Falls Air Force Base in western New York.
We're going to be gathering our evidence and making the case against this decision. We have a lot of reasons why we think it is contrary to military merit and economic value.
These recommendations begin a fifth round of military base closures. In the first four rounds, California received about 30% of all closure orders. This time, no major bases will be closed there. Still, the state will lose about 2,000 jobs. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Los Angeles residents are set to head to the polls next Tuesday to select their choice for mayor. This year's race harks back to 4 years ago when the same two candidates, James Hahn and Antonio Villaraigosa, faced each other. Hahn's latest television ads attack Villaraigosa's efforts at gaining clemency for a convicted drug dealer. Villaraigosa has once again accused Hahn's camp of launching an all-out smear campaign. Both sides accuse the other of corruption. Joining us to talk about the mayor's race is activist Luis Rodriguez, author of Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. Antonio Villaraigosa may be the first Mexican-American or Chicano mayor since 1872. What could this mean for a city like L.A.?
Well, no, I think it's extremely significant because we have such a large Latino population. I think he comes, he comes from L.A. He knows L.A. He has history here. And I think you need a mayor who really, you get the sense that they're, they really understand the issues. And I think Villaraigosa has that. It wouldn't be just that he's, Latino or Chicano. That wouldn't be enough. But I also think he's good on the issues, and that's what's important.
4 years ago, the African-American vote was seen as a crucial factor in Hahn's election, but a lot has changed. Hahn fired African-American police chief Bernard Parks and replaced him with a white police chief, William Bratton, from New York. And a lot of African-American voters saw this as a betrayal on Hahn's part. Bernard Parks ran for mayor himself, and after he was eliminated in the first round, he endorsed Villaraigosa. How do you think that the African-American vote will play out in this race?
Well, it's a very important development because it seems to me that when the city seems to do better, it's when particularly the black and brown community have united around some very good, strong candidates and or issues. I think Tom Bradley was the last time that you could see that kind of unity when he became mayor. And I know that it's been, hard to put that unity together. This is, to me, I look at it as that this doesn't hurt anybody else. When African-Americans and Latinos can come together on political cohesive issues that they can unite around, it helps everybody. This is not just it's not an anti-white or an anti-San Fernando Valley thing. I think it helps anybody when those communities can work together.
Let's talk about the local media. They've recently highlighted perceived tensions between the Latino and African-American communities in L.A. Most recently, the corporate media has really focused on what they've dubbed race riots at schools, although most high school students will agree that it's simply a continuing gang, not race problem. During the last race, the Latino-African-American vote was clearly polarized, and this time it's not. Do you think that it's just a coincidence that the media is playing up this alleged Latino-African-American tension?
Obviously, you have to guess because it's hard to say, but I think I've seen this before. You know what I'm saying? When there's been instances of black and brown unity around the key issues in the city, you start seeing these kind of articles. You start seeing this kind of media attention. Obviously, there is tension in all the communities, and you can always spotlight it and build on it. But it seems to me that when there's instances of the coming together, again, around the issues, again, around what's needed in the city, then you start seeing more of these. So it's hard to say if that's what they're thinking. Obviously, the media would never do that. They wouldn't say that. But people have to pay attention. There's something going on when all of a sudden now we're seeing all these articles about black and brown tensions. Black and brown tensions always exist. They'll probably always be there. But them coming together, to me, that's the story. The fact that they've been able to find a political unifying candidate and a political unifying issue, that to me is the main story. I don't think it's a monolithic vote. I think that that always tends to be the issue. You know, you look at Latinos as a monolith, you look at African Americans, you look at whites. I think people are not that united in that sense. I think whites, like anybody else, have the same concerns. Because the Valley has been considered like, you know, a white enclave, people think you can reach to them by pandering to them. I don't think that works. I think people almost all across the board, what are the issues? What are you going to do about them? What is your plan? How are you going to unite the city? These are things that I think whites, blacks, and Latinos are concerned about. And to me, Villa Vilagrosa seems to be doing that as far as reaching out around these issues and not what I consider pandering to any particular group, because I think that really hurts in the long run.
Luis Rodriguez is an activist and author of Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. Every day, nearly 8,500 people die from AIDS. AIDS activists from around the world are calling on Brazil to keep its promise to make generic AIDS medicines more available. Ingrid Drake from the D.C. Radio Co-op reports from the Brazilian embassy.
Brazil, great! The AIDS drug monopoly, generic! AIDS! Drugs! Now!
A group of demonstrators delivered a styrofoam spine to the Brazilian embassy in Washington, D.C. this morning, urging the Brazilian government to stand up to corporate monopolies on AIDS drugs. While Brazil already provides free anti-HIV and AIDS drugs to anyone who needs them, they have not yet broken drug patents on costly AIDS medicines, says Michelle Weinberger with the Student Global AIDS Campaign.
As U.S. activists, we know that our government is beholden to big pharma and conservative morality. But in contrast, the Brazilian government has been our ally in the fight for public health approaches to HIV and AIDS. Just last week, the Brazilian government turned down U.S. funding for AIDS prevention because it required a condemnation of prostitution. This was unprecedented and brave. We call on Brazil to show this bravery again by breaking the patents and continuing to produce AIDS drugs so that both people in their country and all over the world can receive free and affordable drugs.
Today, almost 80% of Brazil's AIDS budget is spent on imported patented drugs. Sophia LaFontaine.
Of the world's 36 million people living with AIDS and HIV, more than 93% are living in developing countries, such as Brazil. But currently, only 4% of people living with HIV infection receive antiviral drugs.
Brazilian law allows the government to break drug patents in a health emergency or if prices are too high. Last month, Brazil said it would give drug companies until April 4th to either sell drugs at a discounted price or let the government produce generic versions. The deadline has passed, and the government needs to take action, says Akenji Ndumo.
There is still no clear indication that the companies are willing to come to an agreement. Nevertheless, the Ministry of Health of Brazil has not taken action.
A spokesperson for the Brazilian embassy refused to make a public comment when FSRN asked why Brazil has not yet taken action. Mike Bombada with CPT Tech says Brazil is under a lot of pressure.
The American government wants Brazil to send money to American companies, regardless of the effects on public health. So they're going after the Brazilian government on this. They've blacklisted them through the 301 list. They threatened trade sanctions through withholding GSP benefits.
Similar demonstrations also took place in New York and Brazil today, with more than 70 civil society groups in Brazil and 64 international groups making a statement.
We want Brazil to take action now by issuing compulsory licenses for the medicines that are needed to sustain its successful AIDS program and to allow for the export of those medicines that are produced in Brazil to other developing countries who need them and who desperately need them.
Compulsory licenses are legal within Brazilian law and the WTO. They have been adopted by Zambia, Malaysia, and Indonesia to make AIDS drugs more affordable. The Brazilian Health Ministry has said breaking a patent runs the risk of angering pharmaceutical companies who could stop supplying the country with needed drugs.
We will leave this spine for you. We hope that you decide to take action and protect the health of our brothers and sisters living with HIV and AIDS in Brazil. Brazil, break!
Ingrid Drake with the D.C. Radio Co-op for Free Speech Radio News.
Break the AIDS drug monopoly, Brazil!
Many French Muslim organizations are in favor of the upcoming referendum on the European Constitution. Although no organizations are taking an official position and will not call on their members to vote for or against the Constitution, some members are campaigning in favor of the treaty to be voted on by French citizens on May 29. So far, only Tariq Ramadan, a Swiss citizen who is very influential among the French Muslim middle class, has publicly called for a vote against the constitution. But, as Raphael Kraft reports from Paris, most Muslims in France will not be voting according to community beliefs.
They number in the hundreds, kneeling in the street in front of Al-Fatah Mosque in the popular northern district of Barbès in Paris. The mosque, a converted factory, is too small to welcome all the faithful. Moussa Dikidje, the rector, says he doesn't know enough to give his point of view on the European constitution. He says he never mentions political issues in his sermons. His cousin, Mamadou Sakho, a French citizen of Malian origin, will vote in favor of the constitution. As most Muslims in France, Mamadou will not be influenced by what other French Muslims will do.
La France sans l'Europe, ça ne marche pas.
France doesn't work without Europe. Voting yes means voting for continuity because France has always been a driving force in the construction of Europe. So one shouldn't huddle at the last moment.
In a country where strong secularism is deeply rooted in people's minds, Mamadou concedes Europe could offer him a brighter future in the expression of his faith.
I wish Europe would provide more religious liberties. France does guarantee religious liberty, but I believe there are other countries in Europe that are more liberal on religious issues. I'm thinking about Great Britain, for example. They're more advanced than France on this matter.
According to Saïd Brunin, chief editor of Umma.com, one of the most popular Muslim community websites in France, there is no Muslim vote as such.
It's premature to talk about a Muslim vote. We could say a Muslim vote, but that would mean an individual vote, not a community-driven vote.
In the corridors of the UOIF, the Union of Islamic Organizations in France, close to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, executives spread their opinion in favor of the European Constitution, although it has not given its sympathizers orders to vote yet. According to Abdel Ali Bareza, a former UOIF member, the organization has an interest in seeing Europe adopt this constitution.
First of all, the UOIF has an original European vision. One mustn't forget that the UOIF constituted and federated itself through the Union of Islamic Organizations in Europe that groups more European countries than the current members of the European community. So we feel the immediate advantage of going toward the European Union, in which a majority of countries have a maybe more flexible and open vision than France, which is a very strained country on that matter.
While the Mosquée de Paris, the other main Muslim organization in France, is traditionally aligned with the government, the Muslim intellectual current against the European constitution is the one represented by Tariq Ramadan, Saïd Brunin explains.
As a member of the anti-globalization movement, Tariq recently called a vote against the constitution, not for religious, but for economic reasons. He considers this constitution to be ultra-liberal.
While the draft of the European Constitution guarantees the expression of all faith, the debate has been strong in Europe concerning the mention of a religious heritage in the preamble of the Constitution. This heritage should have been Christian for some, spiritual for the most secular. The final draft of the European Constitution does mention a religious heritage without naming it. Indeed, one of the arguments raised against reference to Christianity in the preamble of the European Constitution was the presumed offense to Muslims and the possible impediment to Turkey's entry in the European Union. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
Poverty and social problems have forced girls from a South Indian village into global marriage. So far, some 600 girls have married foreign tourists. While some men stick to the marriages, many of them simply leave the women and children behind. FSRN's Benu Alex reports from Trivandrum.
Currently in India, some 250 million people still live in desperate poverty with an income of less than a dollar a day and no access to wholesome food, basic health, or drinking water. Starvation deaths are often reported in rural areas where nearly 70% of the country's more than 1 billion population lives. Malnutrition is a big problem, as almost half of all children under 5 are malnourished and 34% of newborns are underweight. In the two villages around Kovalam Beach in South India, there are at least 600 girls who have married visiting tourists as a means of escaping poverty. 26-year-old Shashikala started speaking English after she got married to an Italian more than double her age.
So everything is okay. It's very fine. It's good life. My husband and I are not cheating me, sure.
In abject poverty before her marriage, now she owns a house and looks after her family.
I feel liberated after marrying a foreigner. Here it is slavery after marriage. I had enough time to think of this marriage after my husband proposed. I know there are so many who are cheated.
The tourists these young girls marry are in their 70s or 80s. The state of Kerala, where Kovalam is situated, is one of the most literate states in India that holds the record for installing the first ever democratically elected communist government. But it also has the highest number of suicides in the country and a militant workforce. Almost half of the 10,000 families in and around Kovalam are living below the poverty line. Ramchandran is the member of the village council and he says the root of the problem is poverty.
You get instant money, but what is in store for their future? Many foreigners do not come back after a year or two, so these girls go in search of another one. What the foreigners seek is a temporary partner. Basically, it's poverty which forces girls to do this. Only awareness programs can bring a change. To promote tourism, foreigners are given extra protection. And even if we lodge a complaint, they are given preferential treatment.
Dowries are a big barrier parents face when marrying off their daughters. On the other hand, it becomes an incentive when they get married to tourists who pay the girl's family. Though infections like AIDS have not been reported so far, villagers say the day is not too far for that to happen. Rajendra Kumar, the zonal secretary for Communist Party, says legally they can't stop any marriage, but the emotional trauma that these women face are on the rise.
These poor chaps are not able to inquire as to the social status or background of the foreigners. It is more an economic problem, and it can only be addressed if the government understands the basic issue. I think the government should enact a social security law to protect and verify those who get married in this manner.
Girls like Shashikala says, because of this paradox, they are left in lurch and have no option but to find ways to survive in an economy that's tailor-made for the rich. As tourism continues to grow in Kovalam, so do the marriages. From Trivandrum in India, I'm Pinu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.